Every little whisper, they whisper, is it time to start yet? What key is this in? I'm digging that. I didn't know all that stuff went on up here. Excuse me. Hi, I'm Wendell. I'm living love by Jesus. I'm recovering from emotional and spiritual abuse, addiction to food, work, and control. I've had issues with pornography, with alcohol, with rage, panic, and depression. We're talking about codependency. We're on a series here talking about codependency. And the lesson that we had this week, I think it's, we already had it, or maybe we're going to have it. But anyway, we were talking, Jesus was talking about loving your enemies. And the point that he's making is to only love people who are going to love you back, where you're going to get something back, is really not the full experience of love. Really, it goes back for eternity, because God in the Trinity, God the Father, God the Son, not that there was anything around to threaten or challenge that, but suppose there was, they would say, well, it's easy for you to talk about love because you all agree with each other and y'all are, you know, get along real well. Y'all have just perfect community. What does this love look like in the face of mutiny? And I'm not saying that's why God created humans, but that's certainly what we get when we created humans, is that we get a chance to see what love looks like in the face of mutiny, in the face of rebellion, deceit, abuse, you name it. We get a chance to see what love looks like. And so Jesus came along and he started talking about love. Love, 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 all the time. He started talking about love. And he makes the point. He says, it's not, you really don't get the full effect and the full flavor and the full depth and breadth of love if all you do is love people who are going to love you back. Where you get it in return. So he comes up with this novel idea to love your enemies. And so it's that one's always been kind of difficult for me, because most of us avoid our enemies. And probably we might, maybe we should. Maybe that's not a bad idea. You know, I mean, who wants to just walk? Okay, now only two of us in the room are going to get this. Who of us want to walk into a yellow jacket nest? That's me and Bill. We both got stung this week really bad. But who would you intentionally, why would you just intentionally walk into a yellow, do that on purpose? Oh, there you go. There you go. There you go. Yellow jacket's a yellow jacket. But so, you know, it's this whole term of loving your enemies gets kind of vague and gets kind of mushy, because we say, well, I'm really not around my enemies that much. You know, I'm not too much. I've got a boss I don't really like too much. Well, I don't, but you might say that. I love my bosses here. But you might say I've got a boss that I have to work with, or I've got, as you said, a family member I have to deal with, or a neighbor, or, you know, a coach or whatever I have to deal with. But I mean, do they wear the label in your book, enemy? They may be difficult, they may be, you know, cantankerous, they may be cruel, they may be deceitful, but do they wear the label enemy? And it got into my business, terrible. And I was warning the group out there before we came in here, I said, this is not going to be pretty tonight. And I would ask that you would keep all projectiles under the seat, and if I see you reaching, is it back on? So please, you know, no projectiles and no profanity. And if you're going to come after me, give me warning so I can hit the door. But this is going to get into our stuff. It's going to get into my stuff too. But I think for me to get a handle on this, to say who is my enemy, it's better to say, what do I find, or what is it in a person that makes me, that makes them off-putting to me? What is it in them that I find objectionable? All right. Yeah, but it's going to die again. The battery's about dead. Oh, okay.
Ooh, make him like a preacher.
All right. I can hold it. Did y'all catch that? I said I can hold it in here. Good? Okay. Ooh, that is powerful. That we have trouble with our enemies. Maybe it's more like we have trouble with different aspects of them that we find off-putting. And when I started digging into this week, it just kind of crossed my mind when I sat down to my desk to start working on this lesson. The deeper I got, the more probative it got in me. And I thought, oh, shoot, do we really have to talk about this? So let's just dig in. What kinds of things, because this is going to nail us to the wall when we get to the end. I'll just warn you. And I won't. It's not me. It's something Harold said to me about 6 months ago. So I'm going to use a quote of his. So it's his fault when it nails us to the wall. Carry that weight. So I've got five things that we might find as off-putting with other people. And we're going to dig into these five things. One is, some people feel unsafe and dangerous. Some other people feel unattractive or distasteful. The third one is, some people make us feel uncomfortable. It's kind of odd and awkward to be with them. Some people, we find them unacceptable because of their imperfections. They don't match up to our standards. And some people are, I'm using a bunch of so I had to come up with weird words. Unsafe, unattractive, uncomfortable, unacceptable. And the last one is unorganized, which it should be disorganized. But I had to use so it's unorganized. Certain people are, we find them to be unsafe. And here in Pathway, we kind of understand safe and unsafe. That one of the main goals we have as leaders of Pathway is to always, to the best of our ability, have a safe place for people to come. We don't want it to be too religious, because some people have been religiously abused, but we don't want it to be non-Christ-like, because this is faith-based, so it's a balance we have to reach. We don't want to be too loud. We don't want to be too soft. It's just a balance we kind of have to get to make it feel safe for as many people as we can make it feel like. So we understand safe here. So some of us may literally have people in our lives that are unsafe physically. They're unsafe to our physical well-being. Duh. Those kind of people probably just need to be avoided. Or don't visit them unless you have a bodyguard of some sort. So, but let's just get that out of the way. But some people are unsafe to us because they threaten our reputation or they threaten our image. As soon as I got to that, I thought, oh, shoot. That's starting to get into our business, because we have people who we say, if I'm seen with them, people will jump to this conclusion or that conclusion. Or we have people who, if I'm with them and I share something with them, they're likely to misconstrue what I said, or they're likely to come away from that conversation with a different slant than what really took place. They're dangerous because you never know what they're going to say about the encounter. You see what I'm saying? That's rough on my image, because they're blabbermouths and they're going to go out and talk about what went down, and that's not at all what went down, but people are going to believe them. So they prove to be unsafe that way. Some people are dangerous because they bring out the darker side inside of us. That you can be going through the day and you can have love and peace and joy and all the good stuff Jesus talked about, and you meet with this person and all of a sudden you're starting to feel these darker feelings of jealousy, hatred, selfishness, lust, deceit, whatever. There's some people who are dangerous to us because they bring out that darker side. There are other people who threaten emotional triggers in us. They remind us of somebody from our past, somebody who's hurt us. And so I wish I had something profoundly helpful to say here, but I don't. I have not yet figured out what do you do with unsafe people. Boundaries is a good word. Distance is a good word. I mean, you know, I think in my case, I'm not telling you what to do, but in my case, I have to handle it on a case-by-case, person-by-person, encounter-by-encounter basis. It depends on where you are. There are a lot of people around. Is it just me and that person? Is it late at night? Is it in the middle of the day? You know, there are a lot of things to take into account. But some people, let's just stop. We call this the long haul here at Broadway. This is the long haul out here. If you're at that end of the hall and you see somebody come through that door and you recognize who they are, you know that there's certain people, as soon as you see who they are, it's like, oh boy, this could be good. There are other people who you see, and as soon as you do, you think, oh shoot, I got five different doors I could duck into. You know, I really don't want to have an encounter with this person. Okay, so of all these categories that I've named, this is probably the one where I'd want to duck in a door quicker than anybody else. And I think part of it is because they may in fact be dangerous to me, but the biggest reason they're dangerous to me is this: they threaten to bring out the darker side of me. I'm not sure what I'm going to say with them if they threaten me, verbally or any other way. I'm not sure what I'm going to say, what I'm going to say. I kind of know what they're going to say because they have a track record. I don't know what I'm going to say. And once I say it, I can't take it back. You know, I can't regather those words. And so the reason they frighten me, the reason they're a threat to me is because they do, in fact, bring out the darker side in me. So it's really, sometimes the danger is in them, but sometimes it's not that we don't trust them. It's that we don't trust ourselves. And those are the things we, you know, that we have to deal with and we have to get honest with and get real with. So here's number two. First one is unsafe. The second one is unattractive or distasteful. Some people have just a real fine-tuned taste of what is good etiquette and what is tasteful and what is proper and what is improper. There was that way. If you set a table, it had to be set just a certain way. There was a certain way to meet certain people and a certain way to do this and a certain way to do that. That never meant anything to me. I never got it. I never understood it. I remember one of the biggest troubles I ever got into is we were in a formal setting and the butter dish came around. And that was back when there was a butter knife on that dish, not your own knife. So I got a slab of butter and put it on my plate, and then I just licked that knife and put it back. I didn't know you weren't supposed to do that. You know, I had you know what to pay for leaving my DNA on that piece of sterling. But that was big with him. That was big with him. And he was trained by his mother to be that way. It just never took with me, just never hit. You all know what the words etiquette and protocol mean, right? I mean, they just never took with me. But with some people, that's extremely important. And so they look for a certain look in a person. They look for a certain language in a person. They look for a certain level of grammatical precision, you know. They look, and so they want the fashion, the look, the hairstyle, the makeup, everything. They want it to be just so. I'm not sure what to say about that because I don't get that one. But I do know it's important to some people. It's really, really important to some people. It's kind of like if you're this way, you're going to think I'm attacking you. But I don't know that you're that way, so I'm not attacking you. But it's like they run around with this little manual that tells them the next step to take. And everybody who walks in the room, they check the manual on that person. Do they, you know? And I just... You know, if that's you, it's you, really, you know. If it's you, it's you. And I think what's important about recovering, about what we do here, is that you have to own that. And you have to say, I may be the only person in the room, but for some reason, that's really important to me. I look for certain things in a person I want to cuddle up next to. I don't, if they talk a certain way, look a certain way, smell a certain way, no, that, you know, they have to know Emily Post personally. They have to line up with her. I don't get that, but that is important with some people. We need to know that about ourselves. Here's the third one. The person makes me feel uncomfortable. It's awkward to be with them. It's odd. It's different. You know, don't you have kind of a normal way you enter a room full of people? Or if you have friends and you have just certain greetings that just come, you know, you holler something at them, you know, have a certain way you shake hands, or I never have figured out him. That's why he's over there laughing. Every time I see him, he's like, I'm thinking, dude, I don't know all that stuff. It's a personal brother-to-brother joke. He's always the first person I see every day when I come to work, so we don't get much work done. But anyway, you have a normal way that you meet people, you know, and you're just cool with it. You have your shtick, they have their shtick, you know how it, but there are certain people who you just think, I never know what to say to them, and I never know what they're going to say to me. It's just awkward. There could be these long periods of silence. There could be this, you know, they tell jokes that aren't funny. No, he's my best friend. What am I saying? That the best thing you can say is that just it's really awkward to be with them. It's not that you don't like them. It's not that you hate them. It's just awkward. Awkward, awkward. And so you find that kind of off-putting. My normal social techniques don't work. My normal greetings don't work. I don't know how to handle that. So they force me to make uncertain choices in my conversation with them. I think this might work, but I don't know if it will. I've got two granddaughters. They both just had birthdays. One of them could have her own radio show. I mean, literally, she'll carry on a conversation with anybody, and it'll be like she's 25 years old. She's only, what, 8? Yeah. So on her birthday, I called her. Hey, this is Pa. Oh, we had this long conversation. It was just like two adults chatting about political things and the weather and everything else. You know, just, and then the other one, she just had a birthday this last week. So she knew she was going to get a call from Pa, so Pa calls her. And it's like, hey, how are you? Did you have a happy birthday? Yeah. What'd you get for your birthday? Necklace. It's like, will you talk to me? It was a 10-minute conversation? Not quite. And it was, I mean, if she said 5 words, I was lucky. So it's like, I'm not awkward with my granddaughter. But if she wasn't my granddaughter, it would be awkward, you know? There are people in your life that are just like that, and there's no smoothness to the conversation. There's no flow. There are really cool ways to love these people. There are really cool ways to show love to these people. One is just to slow down. Just slow down. You know, ask them how they're doing. If it takes 10 minutes before they come up with a reply, read a comic book or something. You know, they'll come up with something to say. But I think was it about a year ago that you got on this awkward kick? And we literally sat, Wayne and I sat in Jeremy's office, and he taught us about awkward. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. But he just had this, how grace-filled they could be, and it was really cool. I learned a lot from Jeremy at that point. But some of the deepest, most exciting explorations of grace happen in the awkward moments. They really do. Because you have to open yourself up. And you have to put down your expectations and just say, let's just see what happens. Let's just see. This is a beloved child of God. They're different, but they are beloved. And I'm going to learn some things from them if I give myself a chance. So that's number 3, the uncomfortable, awkward, odd situations. The fourth one is unacceptable. In other words, they're imperfect. They're not up to my standards. This is really where I think we have to do some soul searching. Maybe not so much in our social encounters, but more in the work situation. If there's a task that you have to do together, but maybe it could just be a social. But a lot of times it's at work. Their performance just routinely falls short of my expectations. I signed up to work in this place, and I signed up to give this much effort and get this much. I think it's reasonable to say I'm going to give this much. At the end of the day, I'm going to turn around and say I gave that much. And I look over here, and they do that much routinely or less. And they get the same paycheck I get, and they get the same notoriety that I get, and they get the same, you know. But I'm doing this much day after day after day, and they're doing this much day after day after day. That gets tough. They don't complete their work. A lot of it's incorrect. A lot of it's half-assed. It's not thought out. They're tardy. They're inconsistent. They break their promises. You know, I mean, you could just add to that list. And wow, if there's ever an opportunity for grace to give way to judgment, that's where it seems to happen. That we jump from being gracious and merciful to begin to report them, or we want somehow to blow their cover. They're not given as much as I'm given, and they're getting paid as much as I am. This ain't right. And we want to rectify that situation. They're not sincere, they're not passionate, they're not intense, whatever, as I am about life, and they should be. Shame on them. But I've had to do a lot of thinking about that, and it goes back to the old saying, you know, don't judge an Indian until you've walked a mile in his moccasins. I mean, you've heard these things over and over. And Brené Brown, I can't remember, I've read so many of her books, I can't remember which one this came out of, but we've talked about this before in Pathway. Remember when she came home and asked her husband, if you've read her stuff, she came home and asked her husband, do you think everybody's trying to do their best? Do you remember that part in that book? I can't remember what book it was. And he said, yeah, I think so. And she's like, no, they're not. People are half-assing it everywhere. And they're getting away with it. And I don't like it. I mean, she was, you know, and he kept saying, no, I think they really are trying their best. You don't know the load they carry inside of them. You don't know their story. You don't know their history. You don't know everything. And so you assume that they're not putting forth effort. You assume they don't care. You assume they don't have the same passion you have. But your number 10 may be their number 5 because of all the other strikes they have against them. We had a guy, I met a guy, I'm just going to leave it that way, I'm going to leave it as vague as I can, but I met a guy this last week, made good friends with him, and he'd done time. One of the sharpest guys I've talked to in a long time, but he did some time for drugs. He's African American. He has 2 strikes against him in white, privileged America, his color and his record. And talking to him, I thought, good grief, this guy is as sharp as anybody I've ever talked to. This guy is as good, hours after hour after hour. And people would look at him and say, look at him, he's just doing this manual labor. What's wrong with him? He's so much brighter than that. I think he's got 2 strikes against him already, straight out of the chutes. He's got these 2 strikes against him. I have profound respect for that guy. Profound, profound respect for him. And I told him so. And I told his boss, I said, you've got a good guy here, a really good guy here. And his boss said, I know it, which I was glad to hear. But I think what helps me is to realize I was born, in a sense, with a silver spoon in my mouth. I was born in white, privileged America. And I was, you know, given things that a lot of people weren't given. I had my hardships, but I had a lot of opportunities that other people. In Wilmore, we literally had a railroad tracks, and it's just like Bowling Green. People on the other side of the tracks were underprivileged. And I had so many more opportunities than they had, straight out of the chutes, from day one. So I think, to me, this one hits home. But it's a no-brainer when I come to dealing with this in my own heart. I look at them and I say, I have no right to critique that person. That which I think is off-putting to me, I better think twice about that. Because my everything they could come up with. So I better take a look at myself first. Anyway, that got kind of close to home. And then the fifth one is this. We find them to be unorganized. I don't even know if that's a word. Chaotic. It's absolutely impossible to process their world. I don't know what goes through their head. I don't know how they live the life they live. I don't know how they find anything. It's all disorganized and disarray. Their thought patterns, their scheduling, everything is just chaotic. And I have a right to my fragile tranquility. Don't disrupt my fragile, silly. But yes, that's so silly. But yet, I think I've lived much of my life thinking that. We made a joke of that. Stop and let that sink in. That when you go home tonight, when you go home after Pathway, what are you going to do? Don't tell me. Just think. You know what you're going to do. You've already got it set in your mind. You know where you're going to sit. You know what you're going to drink. You know what you're going to look at on TV before you go to bed. You know where you're going to park. You know where you're going to, you know, what you're going to feed the cat. You know, you've got it all figured out. And dadgummit, if somebody chaotic beat on your door, think about it. 9:30, 10 o'clock tonight, they beat on your door and said, "I want to come in. I got to talk to you." You know, and they just start rattling and processing and pouring out. And you're like, "You have just disrupted fragile tranquility." Yeah, I didn't say it right. But that's an extreme, you know. I made it extreme on purpose. But you're working at work. You got a project. It's got to get done. You know, they come in, and boom. Or it's your day off. You get a phone call. It's, you know what I'm saying. So, to say all this tonight is not in any way to condemn anybody, none of us here. It's not to make us feel guilty. It's not even to make us think, "Boy, I got some stuff to work on." I think, to me, this kind of thing is simply holding up a mirror and saying, "Where do I find myself in this? Who am I?" And that nothing, unless you know who you are, nothing will ever change. You know? You have to kind of know who you are in order to know what to surrender and what to think about and what to read about. And what this kind of a session is painful, and yet it's good because it's revelatory. It reveals me to me, and 90% of recovery is discovery, self-discovery. So I want to know who I am, and when I find myself in parts of this lesson, I think, okay, next time I encounter somebody in this long hall, I see them at the other end, and I get that feeling of, where's a door I can duck into? I'm going to think about, what is this? What's going on here? They're not my enemy, but what do I find in them that makes it feel like they're my enemy? Do you get what I'm saying? It's not so much that we have just terrible, vicious enemies. It's that we have aspects inside of people, characteristics, personality traits inside of people that we find so off-putting that it arouses that enemy thing in us. It says, "I don't want to," you know. And I want to understand that about myself. And I want to, I'm not even going to say work on it, because whenever I do that, I mess it up every time. But I want to know about it so that I can say, "Okay, God, there's this thing. Do you want to do something about it?" And y'all know this already, but when I first got in recovery, I realized I had a terrible hatred for my father. That was in 2006. And it wasn't just until, 6 or 8 months ago, I don't remember exactly. I told you all when it happened. 6, 8, 10 months ago, that I found peace with my dad. And it wasn't because I'd worked on it. I'd worked on it and that had failed, so I'd just given it to God and said, "You're going to have to deal with this. Didn't even know what he was doing. And all of a sudden, when Joe Daniel said in group, we got permission to say this, when Joe Daniel said in group, I knew it was time, it opened the gateway inside me, and I was instantly good with my dad. Instantly good. So if, I don't know how recovery works. I don't know. I don't understand it. But I do know that some of these things, if we look at some of these and we say, everything he said is kind of true about me, but that one thing really troubles me about myself. It really, really troubles me about myself. God knows that. God knows that, and the Holy Spirit takes that truth and he begins to do his thing, and I don't know how he does it. I don't even want to know. He does his thing, and then one day you wake up and you realize, I'm in the long haul. I see him coming. I'm not hunting a door. I want to go hug him. I want to go be with him. And I have enough friends here who have had that happen within the last couple weeks, last couple months. They've had people quit smiling at me. I know too much about my brother. I know there are people here who've had this magic moment where, boom, God just changes. Boom, it's all okay now. It's all good. But that's just the way God works. I think I went way over time. I can blame it on no glasses. Yeah, I did go over time. It's all yours, Harold.